so a number of people were interested in, well, what was the structure? How did it differ from the ordinary thing? And so we then figured out how to make it and evaluate it in a small 4 ounce bottle. And then I was able to show that we could make block polymers and we could make copolymers and we could do everything with the thing. So we could make the styrene butadiene copolymers, and then we could make the block polymers. All those were new in the thing. Michael Swark came along sometime after and coined the word living polymer, but we were actually doing all that earlier.
I may be talking to him in September.
Yeah, right. So he's certainly famous for coining the name. But so in my work, I was really the first one to copolymerize butadiene and spamine, and the first one to make some block polymers out of butadiene and styrene. So things went well on that project, and as one of the things that I did in 44 is Phillips Petroleum then wanted to scale it up and actually make quite a bit of it, and they were having trouble getting started, so Marvel sent me down to Bartlesville to help them set up their first pilot plant, and so I went down and spent several weeks down there, and I just came back from a trip to Bartlesville, since Phillips sponsors the ACS Award in Applied Polymer Chemistry. They invited me down to give a talk as a consequence, and I could say that I had been there longer than anybody else in the room. So I went back to 44.
Did they go into production then?
Yeah, they actually went into production. And for a while. They don't make any now, but they actually made some, and we're selling it for some time.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about what it was like doing research at Illinois at that time. Marvel must have been busy at the time. I was going to ask how he was to work for, but I assume that he was probably not as busy as Adams, but certainly at that time was very busy off campus.
Well, that's right. He went to meetings all the time, but he came back and. For instance, while I was there, he was president of the ACS, but they didn't hold any national meetings, so he never got to participate in that. He was actually president a little longer because he was president-elect when Midgley, I guess, was president, and Midgley died in the middle of his term. So Marvel was president for a year and a half, but. During that time, they didn't hold any national meetings. So he still had to go to a few board meetings and things like this as president, but not all the stuff that a president has to do these days. And of course, it was a smaller society then. But he certainly got involved with a large number of these things. Of course, the rubber program, the Oil Production Board, he was quite involved with, and then he got involved with the NDRC, and some of the animal aisles with the managing the some of the national research organization of these things. So he wasn't involved quite as much as Adams, which almost spent full time during the war. So it was a rare occasion when Roger came back, more than anything else. So
how was Marvel as a, let's say, as a research director? He indicated what you thought about him earlier, but
well, he was certainly you know, very relaxed at almost everything he did. He would you know, come in and find out what you were doing and talk to you about it, but really didn't try and push anything. He was you know, very excited when something that would develop, but so he was enthusiastic, but he sort of let you do your own pace and kind of things like this. Now we had to write reports on what we were doing, because the once a month there had to be a report coming out of the rubber program, so you'd turn in a little once a month you had to turn in a sort of report on progress, although it was very short, and then it would be incorporated into the overall report, and so every month it was a pretty thick booklet that left Illinois about the rubber program.
What were the facilities like that you worked in?
Well, they were kind of primitive too. We were in this old building, old noise lab, and we essentially had no hoods. We had a little box with windows that went up and down, and there's no fan on it, so the way we operated was you put a Bunsen burner down this in this chimney, and the heat from the Bunsen burner caused the draft, and we cleaned everything by cooking it in sulfuric acid with a little nitric acid added, so you clean your dishes that way with polymer on it and stuff like that. Obviously we were living on sort of borrowed time, and safety things were not you know, quite what they are today either. I remember this one set of polymerizations that I had. When I was going to set up to do some polymerizations, we didn't have any baths, and so they had an old aquarium with two glass sides, and so Marvel says, "Well, why don't you set that up?" And so I set that up as a constant temperature bath, and I had some bottles in there rotating end over end, and so one night. One of the bottles blew, and it was a sodium polymerization in butadiene. They were fairly far along, and it blew with such force that it blew the sides out of the aquarium, and then water covered the floor, and then the rest of the bottles got hot, and then every once in a while one would go, and it would shoot this napalm containing sodium around, and wherever it hit the water, there would be a flame with a butadiene burning and the rubber floating around. And the night watchman who came around, you know, heard the explosion and came up and you stick his head in there, there'd be a big bomb, and then the stuff would splatter all over, and there'd be a fire here and a fire there and stuff like that. So he tried to he called Marvel, of course, and that was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and at the Axe house we lived up, we all slept up at the fourth floor in a big dormitory, and nobody could hear the telephones, and he tried to wake me and wake somebody, and he couldn't do it. So he spent the rest of the night there, and the night watchman quit after that. He didn't want anything to do with it. So he finally got a hold of George Inskeep, and George came over about 6 o'clock in the morning to do it, and they finally couldn't wake anybody at our place until later in the morning. And so by that time it was all calmed down. So I took quite a bit of kidding on that one, but it was again only because we didn't have everything was makeshift and make do, so we had no fancy equipment or no expensive facilities and things like that. All that came after the war.
Did you have any kind of instrumentation?
Well, very little. In other words, most of the instruments that you think of as instruments weren't even invented yet.
pH meters.
Yeah, we had some. There were some pH meters around, but of course, for organic work, you really didn't do much of that. But see, infrared
and
things
DUs,
like that.
Any Beckman DUs?
Yeah, we had a Beckman around, but that was about all those things. So iron, NMR, and everything like that we used today was gone. And even to determine, the microstructure of the rubber, they were running ozone analysis and then analyzing the products. And Kolhoff on the rubber, who was also on the rubber program, invented this per acid titration, and you get a break in the curve, and then you could extrapolate back. So practically everything was determined by wet chemistry, and very little bit by instrumentation.
Did you do any testing, or were you primarily involved with the synthesis and polymerization?
Mostly just synthesis and polymerization, right. Yeah.
Who would do the testing then? Would that be done at Illinois?
Well, most of it was we would send samples off to a rubber company.
I see.
And they would determine the compression set and the hysteresis, heat rise, and the Mooney viscosity, and all that kind of stuff. And I remember one of our things, we wanted to make enough to build a tire, because no matter how much data you had, nobody would believe it unless you had a tire. And so I made 50 pounds of the rubber in 4 ounce bottles. And that they made a tire out of it, and the tread separated from the carcass in the middle of the test. So we never really found out how good it was.
How long did it take you to make that quantity?
Oh, it was a couple of months.
I was going to say, you had said that, I'm not clear what year you got your degree.
February 46.
February 46. And you were allowed to use the work you were doing for the War Production Board.
That's right. Yeah, right.
Now, had you thought about what was going to happen beyond Illinois?
Well, yeah. When it looked like the war was going to finish and we were going to be able to get out of there, Then I started looking around for some fellowships. I did interview for a couple of teaching jobs, but it was quite obvious that without a postdoc, you really couldn't get a reasonable job. So there were quite a few people in Illinois that were about the same time when everybody could leave that were looking for teaching jobs. And actually, it turned out that there were 45 people in organic chemistry that overlapped me while I was at Illinois, either ahead of me or behind me, that went into teaching.
Wow.
That was just a tremendous number. And not all of them stayed in teaching, but as you go around the country, that's almost everywhere you turn, there is somebody there that I overlapped at Illinois. So there were guys like Bill Parham and Gardner Stacey and Leroy Clem and Virgil Beckelhide and Minor Kuhn and Lester Reed and Pete Kvasic and not all at big universities, but went into teaching of some.
What about going into industry, though?
Well,
was that an alternative?
Well, not at not really at that time. I think the Illinois atmosphere has always sort of been to train people that that would go into industry, but. I think I wanted to go into teaching, and certainly there was an awful lot of other people there that were thinking along the same lines. And so I applied for a number of postdoc fellowships, and I got an offer from Fieser at Harvard, and Marvel says to me, "Well, you don't want to go to Harvard, you're this Midwestern boy, they'll just chew you up and spit you out." And he says, "I think you should go work for Cope." He's a more of an easier going guy and knows how to do everything. And so I think your personality and everything would fit more with Cope than some of the other people that I had think. So he arranged with Art for me to go to MIT, and then Cope got me the RCG little postdoctoral fellowship there.
Didn't Overberger go to Cope with Cope at the same time?
That's right, and then Pete Kvasic also. So the three of us went to there, and Charlie and I worked in the same lab in Illinois, and then worked in the same lab together at MIT. And Cope was just a principal guy to work for, too.
So. I was going to ask you how he was to work for. Did you have supervision of other graduate students?
No.
Or were you on your own?
Well, yeah, I was on my own. Cope was also pretty busy, but when he was in town, he made sure that he talked to everyone in this group. So when he was there, he would come around and sit down and chat with you for quite an extended time. And of course, that was a good time to be at MIT because he had just moved from Columbia up there and had brought in Jack Roberts and John Sheehan, Gardner Swain, at that time, and they all had small groups. They were all just getting started, so we had joint research seminars together. So it was really terrific interacting with those four who were really high-powered research guys.
Yeah.
See how they thought, and when he was there, we all had lunch together, and as a group. So, and then had the research seminars, and so we got a lot closer supervision with Cope than I did with Marvel, but that was just a happenstance of his moving. And as he developed a bigger group and the department got bigger and things, a lot of the students complained that they ever saw him, but that wasn't the time, the period that I had the contact with him. And so it was a very, very productive year in the sense that that was the first time I didn't have courses, didn't have any exams to take, didn't have any thesis to write, and so I could concentrate on doing research, and then sitting in on these advanced courses that Sheehan and Roberts and things like that were offering. So the things that I would have worked on when I left Illinois were not the things that I was going to work on when I finished my postdoc, and so it was a real productive year then.
You worked on cyclooctatetraene, and in fact, that particular period, Cope has any number of papers on that particular molecule. What was so important about its chemistry at that time?
Well. That was, historically that had been a controversy for years and years and years. Willstetter had synthesized cyclooctatetraene way back, by classical methods. And then during the 30s then, when people became interested in the Huckel rule, whether cyclooctatetraene would be aromatic or not, and so all those kind of compounds became of interest, and then people had tried to synthesize it and apparently it failed, and then there were a whole bunch of papers pointing out the similarity in physical properties of cyclooctatetraene and styrene. And so there were quite a few papers that says, well, Willstetter didn't have cyclooctatetraene, he had styrene. And Cope decided that he would like to investigate that. And then when Repi synthesized cyclooctatetraene from acetylene, and Cope thought that was something that he really wanted to investigate. So Charlie Oldberger duplicated the Willstetter synthesis, and I synthesized it from chlorpyrene. And that was a new synthesis, and that was then adaptable to making derivatives of cyclooctatetraene. So Cope synthesized a number of other derivatives and studied some of the chemistry and everything based on some of the work that we did and the modification of some of the Repi chemistry.
You touched on this just briefly before, but it was something I had in my list of questions also. You were still single at this time.
Yeah.
Is this your first time in Boston, the Boston area?
Yeah.
What was that like compared to the Midwestern life of Illinois and Minnesota?
Of course, I could never quite get used to the Bostonian atmosphere in one sense. It was the only place that I've ever, even now, that I can remember, stopping somebody on the street and asking them how to get to someplace else, and they turn around and walk away from you. So they didn't have much truck with strangers and mm-hmm. and things of that ilk. Although the culture was fabulous around there. We would get they would sell tickets to plays at MIT where they'd turn in some of the unused things, and we'd go over there and buy them at half price. And some of the concerts to the Boston Symphony and everything we could get at a fraction of their face value and stuff like that. So I participated in a lot of things that I never could back in Minneapolis or certainly Urbana. So that was quite interesting.
Was the situation in academe changing during that year? Or you had to be looking beyond MIT now?
It was probably a good time to come out because, of course, when I finished my postdoc, then a lot of the schools had gotten all these veterans back. And most schools were looking for additional faculty, and so the more senior people, of course, a lot of them went out that had been around Illinois for longer than I had after they got their degree. Some of those got jobs right out of Illinois and didn't take a postdoc. Somebody like Ben Acock went to Wisconsin directly out of Illinois without a postdoc, but so when I finished up as a postdoc, I sort of had a choice of a few places to go, and one of the jobs that I considered, of course, was I was given offered an instructorship at Columbia, and that was a tough road, and then I was the one offer that I had that was attractive. Was at Wayne State. It was Wayne University then, it wasn't State University at that time. And Neil Gordon was the chairman of the department, and Herb Brown was there.
Oh, that's right.
And so I said, well, if Herb Brown was there and did well, I should be able to do well as well. And but the job at Columbia, I think, only paid $3,600 for an academic year, and the job at Wayne paid $4,700, among other things. And
that's a surprising.
Detroit was obviously a cheaper place to live than New York as well, so that was attractive. I reported to Wayne, and it wasn't long after I was there that Brown left for Purdue and left me with the only one in organic that was interested in research. So that was really a baptism of fire, since I was teaching all the advanced courses, and I gave 18 lectures a week and picked up 10 graduate students that first year. So I got a flying start.
I have a number of things I wanted to ask you about that. But I do want to ask you first, did COPE help you at all in looking for these academic positions?
Well, a reasonable amount, yeah. he would pass on leads that he had gotten and talk to people. He didn't quite do what Lee Irvin says, here you're going here, or what Marvel says, you're going to MIT to work for Ad Cope. But